Tonight's topic is the new fascism, ruled by consensus. And when an audience of this size on a night such as we are going through now appears, you obviously don't want to hear from me. You want to hear from Miss Ayn Rand. Miss Rand.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I shall begin by doing a very unpopular thing that does not fit today's intellectual fashions and is therefore anti-consensus. I shall begin by defining my terms so that you will know what I'm talking about. Let me give you the dictionary definition of three political terms: socialism, fascism, and statism. Quote, socialism, a theory or system of social organization which advocates the vesting of the ownership and control of the means of production, capital, land, etc., in the community as a whole. Fascism, a governmental system with strong centralized power, permitting no opposition or criticism, controlling all affairs of the nation, industrial, commercial, etc. Statism, the principle or policy of concentrating extensive economic, political, and related controls in the state at the cost of individual liberty. These definitions are from the American College Dictionary, 1957. It is obvious that statism is the wider generic term of which the other two are specific variants. It is also obvious that statism is the dominant political trend of our day. But which of those two variants represents the specific direction of that trend? Observe that both socialism and fascism involve the issue of property rights. The right to property is the right of use and disposal. Observe the difference in those two theories. Socialism negates private property rights altogether and advocates the vesting of ownership and control in the community as a whole, that is, in the state. Fascism leaves ownership in the hands of private individuals but transfers control of the property to the government. Ownership without control is a contradiction in terms. It means property without the right to use it or to dispose of it. It means that the citizens retain the responsibility of holding property without any of its advantages, while the government acquires all the advantages without any of the responsibility. In this respect, socialism is the more honest of the two theories. I say more honest, not better, because in practice there is no difference between them. Both come from the same collectivist statist principle, both negate individual rights, both deliver the livelihood and the lives of the citizens into the power of an omnipotent government, and the differences between them are only a matter of time, degree, and superficial detail, such as the choice of slogans by which the rulers delude their enslaved subjects. Which of these two variants of statism are we moving toward, socialism or fascism? To answer this question, one must first ask, which is the dominant ideological trend of today's culture? Ladies and gentlemen, the shocking, the disgraceful, the terrifying answer is there is no ideological trend today. There is no ideology. There are no political principles, theories, ideals, or philosophy. There is no direction, no goal, no compass, no vision of the future, no intellectual element of leadership. Are there any emotional elements dominating today's culture? Yes, one, fear. A country without a political philosophy is like a ship drifting at random in mid-ocean, at the mercy of any chance wind, wave, or current. A ship whose passengers huddle in their cabins and cry, "Don't rock the boat," for fear of discovering that the captain's bridge is empty. It is obvious that a boat which cannot stand rocking is doomed already, and that it had better be rocked hard if it is to regain its course. But this realization presupposes a grasp of fact, of reality, of principles, and a long-range view, all of which are precisely the things that the non-rockers are frantically struggling to evade. Just as a neurotic believes that the facts of reality will vanish if he refuses to recognize them, so today the neurosis of an entire culture leads men to believe that their desperate need of political principles and concepts will vanish if they succeed in obliterating all principles and concepts. But since, in fact, neither an individual nor a nation can exist without some form of ideology, this sort of anti-ideology is now the formal, explicit, dominant ideology of our bankrupt culture. This anti-ideology has a new and very ugly name. It is called government by consensus. If some demagogue were to offer us as a guiding creed the following tenets: that statistics should be substituted for truth, vote counting for principles, numbers for rights, and public polls for morality, that pragmatic range of the moment expediency should be the criterion of a country's interests, and that the number of its adherents should be the criterion of an idea's truth or falsehood, that any desire of any nature whatsoever should be accepted as a valid claim, provided it is held by a sufficient number of people, that a majority may do anything it pleases to a minority. In short, gang rule and mob rule. If a demagogue were to offer it, he would not get very far. Yet all of it is contained in and camouflaged by the notion of government by consensus. This notion is now being plugged not as an ideology, but as an anti-ideology. Not as a principle, but as a means of obliterating principles. Not as reason, but as rationalization, as a verbal ritual or a magic formula to assuage the national anxiety neurosis, a kind of pep pill or goofball for the non-boat rockers, and a chance to play deuces wild for the others. It is only today's lethargic contempt for the pronouncements of our political and intellectual leaders that blinds people to the meaning, implications, and consequences of the notion of government by consensus. You have all heard it, and I suspect dismissed it as politicians' oratory, giving no thought to its actual meaning. But that is what I urge you to consider. A significant clue to that meaning was given in an article by Tom Wicker in the New York Times of October 11, 1964, referring to, quote, what Nelson Rockefeller used to call the mainstream of American thought, unquote. Mr. Wicker writes, quote, that mainstream is what political theorists have been projecting for years as the national consensus, what Walter Lippmann has aptly called the vital center. Political moderation, almost by definition, is at the heart of the consensus. That is, the consensus generally sprawls over all acceptable political views, all ideas that are not totally repugnant to and do not directly threaten some major segment of the population. Therefore, acceptable ideas must take the views of others into account, and that is what is meant by moderation. Unquote. Now let us identify what this means. The consensus generally sprawls over all acceptable political views. Acceptable to whom? To the consensus. And since the government is to be ruled by the consensus, this means that political views are to be divided into those which are acceptable and those which are unacceptable to the government. What would be the criterion of acceptability? Mr. Wicker supplies it. Observe that the criterion is not intellectual, not a question of whether certain views are true or false. The criterion is not moral, not a question of whether the views are right or wrong. The criterion is emotional, whether the views are or are not repugnant. To whom? To some major segment of the population. There is also the additional proviso that those views must not directly threaten that major segment. What about the minor segments of the population? Are the views that threaten them acceptable? What about the smallest segment, the individual? Obviously, the individual and the minority groups are not to be considered. No matter how repugnant an idea may be to a man, and no matter how gravely it may threaten his life, his work, his future, he is to be ignored or sacrificed by the omnipotent consensus and its government, unless he has a gang, a sizable gang, to support him. What exactly is a direct threat to any part of the population? In a mixed economy, every government action is a direct threat to some men and an indirect threat to all. Every government interference in the economy consists of giving an unearned benefit extorted by force to some men at the expense of others. By what criterion of justice is a consensus government to be guided? By the size of the victim's gang. Now note Mr. Wicker's last sentence. Therefore, acceptable ideas must take the views of others into account, and that is what is meant by moderation. And just what is meant here by the views of others? Of which others? Since it is not the views of individuals nor of minorities, the only discernible meaning is that every major segment must take into account the views of all the other major segments. But suppose that a group of socialists wants to nationalize all factories, and a group of industrialists wants to keep its properties. What would it mean for either group to take into account the views of the other? And what would moderation consist of in such a case? What would constitute moderation in a conflict between a group of men who want to be supported at public expense and a group of taxpayers who have other uses for their money? What would constitute moderation in a conflict between the member of a minority group, such as a Negro in the South, who believes that he has an inalienable right to a fair trial, and the much larger group of Southern racists who believes that the so-called public good of their community permits them to lynch him? What would constitute moderation in a conflict between me and a communist, or between our respective followers, when my views are that I have an inalienable right to my own life, liberty, and happiness, and his views are that the so-called public good of the state permits him to rob, enslave, or murder me? There can be no meeting ground, no middle, no compromise between opposite principles. There can be no such thing as moderation in the realm of reason and of morality. But reason and morality are precisely the two concepts abrogated by the notion of government by consensus. The advocates of that notion would declare at this point that any idea which permits no compromise constitutes extremism that any form of extremism, any uncompromising stand, is evil, that the consensus sprawls only over those ideas which are amenable to moderation, and that moderation is the supreme virtue, superseding reason and morality. This is the core, the essence, the motive, the real meaning of the doctrine of government by consensus, the cult of compromise. Compromise is the precondition, the necessity, the imperative of a mixed economy. The consensus doctrine is an attempt to translate the brute facts of a mixed economy into an ideological or anti-ideological system and to provide them with a semblance of justification. A mixed economy is a mixture of freedom and controls, with no principles, rules, or theories to define either. Since the introduction of controls necessitates and leads to further controls, it is an unstable, explosive mixture which ultimately has to repeal the controls or collapse into dictatorship. A mixed economy has no principles to define its policies, no principles to define its goals, no principles to define its laws, no principles to limit the power of its government. The only principle of a mixed economy, which necessarily has to remain unnamed and unacknowledged, is that no one's interests are safe, everyone's interests are on a public auction block, and anything goes for anyone who can get away with it. Such a system, or more precisely, anti-system, breaks up a country into an ever-growing number of enemy camps, into economic groups fighting one another for self-preservation in an indeterminate mixture of defense and offense, as the nature of such a jungle demands. While politically, a mixed economy preserves the semblance of an organized society with a semblance of law and order, economically, it is the equivalent of the chaos that had ruled China for centuries, a chaos of robber gangs looting and draining the productive elements of the country. A mixed economy is ruled by pressure groups. It is an amoral, institutionalized civil war of special interests and lobbies, all fighting to seize the momentary control of the legislative machinery, to extort some special privilege at one another's expense by an act of government, that is, by force. In the absence of individual rights, in the absence of any moral or legal principles, a mixed economy's only hope to preserve its precarious semblance of order, to restrain the savage, desperately rapacious groups it itself has created, and to prevent the legalized plunder from running over into plain, unlegalized looting of all by all, is compromise. Compromise on everything and in every realm, material, spiritual, intellectual, so that no group would step over the line by demanding too much and topple the whole rotted structure. If the game is to continue, nothing can be permitted to remain firm, solid, absolute, untouchable. Everything and everyone has to be fluid, flexible, indeterminate, approximate. By what standard? The expediency of any immediate moment. The only danger to a mixed economy is any not to be compromised value, virtue, or idea. The only threat is any uncompromising person, group, or movement. The only enemy is integrity. It is unnecessary to point out who will be the steady winners and who the constant losers in a game of that kind. It is also clear what sort of unity of consensus that game requires. The unity of a tacit agreement that anything goes, anything is for sale or for negotiation, and the rest is up to the free-for-all of pressuring, lobbying, manipulating, favor-swapping, public relationing, give-and-taking, double-crossing, begging, bribing, betraying, and chance, the blind chance of a war in which the prize is the privilege of using legal armed force against legally disarmed victims. Now observe that this type of prize establishes one basic interest held in common by all the players, the desire to have a strong government, a government of unlimited power, strong enough to let the winners and would-be winners get away with whatever they're seeking. A government uncommitted to any policy, unrestrained by any ideology, and hoarding power, an ever-growing power, power for power's sake, which means for the sake and use of any major gang who might seize it momentarily to ram their particular piece of legislation down the country's throat. Observe, therefore, that the doctrine of compromise and moderation applies to everything except one issue, any suggestion to limit the power of the government. Observe the torrent of vilification, abuse, and hysterical hatred unleashed by the moderates against any advocate of freedom, that is, of capitalism. Observe that such designations as extreme middle or militant middle are being used by people seriously and self-righteously. Observe the inordinately vicious intensity of the smear campaign against Senator Goldwater, which had the overtones of panic. The panic of the moderates, the vital centrists, the middle of the roaders, in the face of the possibility that a real pro-capitalism movement might put an end to their game. A movement, incidentally, which does not exist as yet, since Senator Goldwater was not an advocate of capitalism, and since his meaningless, unphilosophical, unintellectual campaign has contributed to the entrenchment of the consensus advocates. I don't know whether you're with me or against me, but thank you. Then we understand each other. But what is significant here is the nature of their panic. It gave us a glimpse of their wanted moderation, their democratic respect for the people's choices, and their tolerance of disagreement or opposition. In a letter to the New York Times, June 23, 1964, an assistant professor of political science, fearing Goldwater's nomination, wrote as follows, quote, "The real danger lies in the divisive campaign which his nomination would provoke. The result of a Goldwater candidacy would be a divided and embittered electorate. To be effective, American government requires a high degree of consensus and bipartisanship on basic issues." Unquote. When and by whom has statism been accepted as the basic principle of America, and as a principle which should now be placed beyond debate or dissension so that no basic issues are to be raised any longer? Isn't that the formula of a one-party government? The professor did not specify. Another letter writer in the New York Times of June 24, 1964, identified in print as a liberal Democrat, went a little further. Quote, "Let the American people choose in November. If they choose overwhelmingly for Lyndon Johnson and the Democrats, then once and for all the federal government can get on with no excuses with the job millions of Negroes, unemployed, aged, sick, and otherwise handicapped persons expected to do, to say nothing of our overseas commitments. If the people choose Goldwater, then it would seem the nation was hardly worth saving after all." Moderation. Woodrow Wilson once said that there is such a thing as being too proud to fight. Then he had to go to war. Once and for all, let us have it out while the battle yet can be fought with ballots instead of bullets. Unquote. does this gentleman mean that if we don't vote his way, he will resort to bullets? Your guess is as good as mine. The New York Times, which had been a conspicuous advocate of government by consensus, said some curious things in its appraisal of President Johnson's victory. Its editorial of November 8, 1964 stated, quote, "No matter how massive the electoral victory, and it was massive, the administration cannot merely ride the crest of the popular wave rolling along on a sea of platitudinous generalizations and euphoric promises. Now that it has a broad popular mandate, it has the moral as well as the political obligation not to try to be all things to all men, but to settle down to a hard, concrete, purposeful course of action." Unquote. What kind of purposeful action? If the voters were offered nothing but platitudinous generalizations and euphoric promises, how can their vote be taken as a broad popular mandate? A mandate for an unnamed purpose, a political blank check? And if Mr. Johnson did win a massive victory by trying to be all things to all men, then which things is he now expected to be? Which voters is he to disappoint or betray? And what becomes of the broad popular consensus? Morally and philosophically, that editorial is highly dubious and contradictory. But it becomes clear and consistent in the context of a mixed economy's anti-ideology. The president of a mixed economy is not expected to have a specific program or policy. A blank check on power is all that he asks the voters to give him. Thereafter, it's up to the pressure group game, which everybody is supposed to understand and endorse, but never mention. Which things he will be to which men depends on the chances of the game and on the major segments of the population. His job is only to hold the power and to dispense the favors.